Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program of analysis of the economic events, trends, facts that shape our incomes, our jobs, our debts, our futures, those of our kids, and those of our communities. My name is Richard Wolff. I'm your host on Economic Update every week. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I also write economic columns regularly, among others, for Truthout, truthout.org, a remarkable and worthwhile independent source of news and analysis every day. And it is a pleasure for me to urge you to take a look at what you can get on a daily basis from truthout.org. If this program and the kinds of analyses we provide are of interest to you, please know that we maintain two websites, 24/7 at absolutely no charge for you, where we put up lectures I give, classes I teach, interviews I do on mass media, materials related to the kinds of discussions you hear and see on this program. And I'd like to invite you to make use of these websites. The first one is rdwolf.com, and the other one is democracyatwork.info. Not only do they have all of the items I just listed, but there are two other things you might find useful. First, by going to either website, you can click on the relevant icon, and that way you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, which we urge you to do because it's yet another way to engage the materials that we focus on these programs. And finally, both websites provide you with a way to email us your thoughts, your questions, your criticisms. We read them all, and we use them to shape this program, and towards the end, pick one or two of your questions and comments to respond to. Please bear with us. We get many more of these comments and questions than we possibly have time for. We try to select those that represent what many of you are communicating to us. Without further ado, let me turn to the economic updates for today. The first one has to do with the largest single private employer in the United States, the Walmart Corporation. Walmart has been in the news now a good year or longer because of a massive corruption scandal having to do with its operations in Mexico. In defense of itself, Walmart is promising to cooperate with authorities doing the various investigations that are ongoing. It boasts that it has spent over $439 million working to comply with existing laws, mostly having to do with bribing foreign officials to gain competitive advantages, in this case in Mexico, although Walmart has had these problems elsewhere as well. They also mentioned that they have hired thousands of people. Granted, Walmart has millions of employees, but Walmart has hired thousands of people whose job is to do nothing other than what's called compliance, which is a polite word for saying people hired to make sure that the company who hires them is not doing illegal things, is complying with the law. It's a little dangerous concept to have this sort of self-monitoring. Hasn't worked real well in the history of capitalism in the past, and there's not much reason to believe it's going to make much of a difference with Walmart. But that's really not my concern for today. My concern for today is that we understand what some of the social costs are to the kinds of corruption endemic to large capitalist corporations and enormous in the case, not surprisingly, of one of the biggest capitalist corporations, in this case, Walmart. Let's take a look. Walmart's basic role in Mexico has been to move into that society as a department store, which is what Walmart chiefly is, as a mammoth store selling vast arrays of commodities. Walmart wanted to get into Mexico because it saw Mexico as a kind of place where it could do its business. Mexico is a relatively poor society, although not as poor as many in the world. Had a system of stores that might be described as ancient in the sense that in many, many, many Mexican villages, some of the local people set up stores, often in a garage, often in the back of their home, often in a small structure somewhere in the town or the village. and they buy from wholesalers and resell to the local population. The reason this is important, that retail stores were so small and scattered, is that they provided an income and a living to millions of Mexican folks, small-time merchants in small villages and towns scattered across the country. What Walmart intended to do was to drive them out of business, to offer big stores where Mexican shoppers could come, and more convenient than relying on the local shop, perhaps cheaper than relying on the local shop, because Walmart could force lower prices on the producers they bought from. Whatever the case, to allow Walmart to come in, which is what Walmart wanted to do, and which is why, and major reason why, Walmart bribed so many Mexican officials, was to speed up that process, to overcome barriers, cultural, political, regulatory, and so on. And so they found corrupt Mexican officials willing to give them extra legal help, illegal help, in exchange for bribes. Well, what did that do? Well, it had enormous social effects, about which, obviously, neither Walmart nor the corrupt officials in Mexico cared much. They were busy making their money, Walmart by expanding, officials by getting bribes. So millions, and I mean millions of Mexicans in Mexico, were fundamentally deprived of their livings when they were no longer able to function alongside a Walmart, which was not only able to be a cheaper seller, but one of the reasons Walmart could undercut the local Mexicans was because they had gotten all kinds of preferences, which they paid for by bribing, which the small local retail merchant in Mexico cannot compete with, can't provide million-dollar bribes to people. So millions of Mexican merchants, let's call them, shopkeepers, lost their job. And Mexico being a poor company, there's no place for these people to go to get jobs to replace the jobs destroyed by Walmart's bribery entrance into Mexico. So millions of these Mexicans were faced with an inability to live in Mexico and therefore made the choice to move north into the United States, the place where they might at least find some work, albeit underpaid, albeit under tremendous pressure because of immigration laws, and so on. And yet, how often do you hear Americans understanding that whatever they may think about immigration, blaming the immigrant is usually blaming the person least responsible for what's going on? Mexicans, like most people, do not want to leave their home. That's where their families are. That's where their husbands and wives are. That's where their communities are, their relatives, their friends, their towns, their churches, you name it. To go and rip all of that away from your life and go into a country that doesn't seem so clearly interested in having you, where you suffer all kinds of indignities and discriminations, is not something you do as a casual decision. Usually, immigrants are forced out of their society at least as much as they are attracted by going somewhere else. Walmart is a major reason, just like corruption across the board with other big capitalist corporations, for the immigration that we normally discuss as if the real causes of it, these capitalist enterprises and their corruption, which they admit, were not a major factor to be taken into account. Let me turn then to another fact that became clear over the last week, because of research done by Citibank in New York, one of the United States' largest banks, and reported by the Bloomberg Financial News Service. Here's what this statistic is, and I want to say something about it. Between 2003 and 2010, when Americans were feeling pretty good about the economy because the crisis we're in hadn't hit yet, and where they were told that things would never get bad the way they have, and that things would only get better the way they haven't, they went ahead and they bought cars as they needed them. After several years, when a used car becomes a problem, they go and they have to buy another car. And the average American, of course, buys cars on time because they don't have enough money to buy a car outright in cash. Well, between 2003 and 2010, the rate of delinquency, that is the proportion of outstanding car loans where the person who took out the loan can't pay it back, can't make that monthly payment, was between 4 and 5%. But since 2010, things have gotten much worse. Now the rate of delinquency between 2010 and right now is between 8 and 9%. That is double what it was before. Why do I bring this up? Because it's a wonderful way to show the other side of the so-called recovery in our economy, a recovery which, in fact, is only really affecting the top 5% of our population, the biggest corporations and the richest individuals. Why are these statistics about delinquency and car loans, why are they important? Because they teach us two things. First, that all the hoopla about people getting jobs again and car sales being a major promoter of the idea that we're getting back to normalcy, this is false. Why? The reason people are buying cars is the cars they bought before are now getting older and older, and the cost of continually repairing them and fixing them up is becoming prohibitive, and you're kind of forced to go and buy a new car. But because the crisis is here, and not only have jobs not recovered to anything like what they were before the crisis, but throughout the last 5 years, the real wage, the amount of money in terms of its purchasing power that workers who have jobs are getting has been flat to shrinking, forced to buy cars, Americans are in poorer shape than they used to be to afford them, which is why when they borrow to buy the car now, which they must to get to work, to run their lives, they're having to borrow money they can't afford. A 8 to 9% delinquency rate is proof positive of the extraordinary decline in the capacity of the American economy to function. So when you hear about, oh, rising car sales, or, ooh, recovery, be aware we are again keeping our economy going on a poor level that it is, but on borrowed time and borrowed money. And the risk of another collapse, another downturn, is building as we go. You don't raise wages, this is the result. My next update has to do with a nice piece of research done by Michael Mazeroff, M-A-Z-E-R-O-V. He works for the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, the CBPP, whom you can find on the internet. He did a piece of research on state taxes and their impact on citizens moving from one state in the United States to another. Why do I bring this up? Well, corporations and rich people make the following argument. They've been doing it for decades. You mustn't raise taxes on us in each state. You mustn't raise the state taxes on corporate profits or the state taxes on rich people, because if you do, you will drive the corporations and you will drive the people, the rich people who run them and who manage them, to leave your state. So Michael Mazeroff said, let me take a look. Let's take a look at the different states, at movement between states, and to see whether there's a relationship between people moving from state A to state B and the taxes levied in those two states on corporations and the rich. And the reason, of course, I bring it to your attention is that his results were unambiguous. State taxes have little or no effect on people moving from one state to another. Here's what he found. The reasons people move from one state to another are the following, the major reasons. Jobs. Do you lose a job in one state and there is a job you might have in another state, you move. Number two, family reasons. To be either closer to your family or, depending on the family you have, further away from them. But family issues make people move. And finally, the third big one, retirement. If you live in a cold state, you may want to retire to a warm state. If you live in an urban area, you may want to retire to a rural area or vice versa. Taxes play little or no role. So what's the lesson here? When corporations and rich people don't want to pay taxes. They never can say openly and honestly, and I have never heard it, well, we don't want to pay taxes because we would rather middle and lower income people pay the taxes to run the society. They can't say that because to say that is so bald and so honest that it would get them into trouble. And they've long ago learned, here's the clever thing to do. Tell people, convince people if you can, that raising taxes on corporations and the rich will hurt them, so they shouldn't do it. And one argument is, don't tax corporations and the rich, because then the corporations will leave, taking their jobs with them, and the rich people will leave, and that will leave us in a sea of poverty. The argument is really, don't tax corporations and the rich, make the rest of us pay. But they put on the veneer as if they're concerned about movement of people. When we finally have a study of whether people move because of state taxes, the unambiguous result is they don't. The next update economically. This has to do with energy, a very big issue, of course, in the United States. And here I found very useful something from an interesting website called oilprice.com. And this was from the June 2nd edition of the website, a piece by Daniel Graeber, G-R-A-E-B-E-R. Here's what I learned, and I thought you might be interested to know. If you look at the United States today, its energy needs are roughly met as follows. 82% of the energy needs of the United States are provided by fossil fuels, gas and oil, and so on. 10% are by renewable resources, you know, solar, wind power, and things like that. And 8% nuclear. 82% fossil fuels, 10% renewable resources, 8% nuclear. Around the world, including here in the United States, there have been pledges made over recent years to raise the amount of our energy that we meet by renewable resources that are less damaging to the environment, solar, wind, and so on, from 10%, which it is now, to 20%. In Europe, major progress in that direction has been made, so that the goal of having 20% renewable sources for our energy by 2020 is more than halfway met in most European countries. We're not even close in this country. Half the states in the United States haven't even committed themselves to that goal, let alone making progress. So the interesting question is, despite all the hoopla, particularly last week from the Obama administration, why is the progress in the United States so much slower than in Europe? And try as I might, here's the only answer I can come up with. Advocates for ecology, environmentalism, green this and that in the United States are leery about forming political parties. They're leery about working with established critical political parties, that is, other than the Republicans and Democrats, who clearly are the ones making sure that whatever progress we have is very slow. Whereas in Europe, that's not the case. In Europe, green political parties are very powerful in Germany, in France, in Italy. In a variety of countries, green parties are either themselves a political force or work in coalition, typically with other left-wing, not always, but mostly left-wing political parties. So the question arises whether the goal you seek to reach might be better advanced if you were more willing and able to work politically in a political organization contesting for elections, but also active outside the electoral process. That certainly is one lesson that seems to come from these economic statistics. Now, two quick economic updates. This last week, Seattle, Washington finally passed the $15 an hour minimum wage that will become the law in that city when it takes effect in 2017. We have reported on the effort around the country to get this kind of law passed, but Seattle is the first major city in which this has now been officially done. We want to recognize that a major force, not the only one, but a major force getting this done, was the socialist alternative political campaigns of Ms. Sawant over there, Kshama Sawant. And I want to recognize what she achieved, both for Seattle but for everyone else. She defeated, as I have reported in the past, a longtime liberal Democrat to become a member of the city council in Seattle, a socialist, explicitly socialist member, and now she has gone on to help achieve a real breakthrough. I do want to mention that there are other cities looking seriously now at $15 per hour minimum: Chicago, Providence, Rhode Island, San Francisco, Los Angeles. The Pew Trust, that does lots of surveys around the country, shows that a clear majority of Americans support raising the minimum wage from the $7.25 it is now to the $10.10 an hour that has been endorsed by President Obama. There is a lesson here. You know, the minimum wage is a kind of sign of what kind of commitment a society has, not only to make millionaires out of a handful of people, but to provide a decent minimum for the average person, for folks at the bottom. It's a way of measuring the decency in a society or not. The constant drumbeat from the right that a minimum wage increase is somehow bad economics is simply silly. Every economic step you take has multiple ramifications. Very hard to figure out in most cases what the net effect is, because there are so many effects, and many of them last into the future, and you don't know yet what the future is going to bring. Is it possible, and I'm saying this for the umpteenth time, is it possible that if you raise the minimum wage, there will be some employers so upset by having to pay people a $15 an hour or $10 an hour that they will literally close their operations or move them, thereby depriving these people of a job? The answer is probably there are some. They won't be many, because the profitability of the companies like Walmart and McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken that pay these awful wages is such that they're in no danger whatsoever of making major decisions because they have to pay people at the bottom $10 or $15 an hour. But are there some? Yes. The people against the minimum wage want you to think about that. But here's the other side of that coin, which simple economics will teach you. If you pay millions of people, and that's what we're talking about, more money, significantly more money than they have been earning for the jobs they do, they will be able to spend more money. They will be able to go into McDonald's and Walmart more than they have in the past. And whatever McDonald's suffers by having to pay a higher minimum wage has to be offset in your mind and in your analysis by all the extra profits they will earn from all the people at the bottom whose increase in the minimum wage allows them to go to Walmart more often, to buy more hamburgers at McDonald's, etc. Without balancing these two together, you can't reach a conclusion as to what an increase in the minimum wage does. So if you're concerned about the economic effects, they are what we call in economics indeterminate. They depend on many other factors. But if you're motivated by a morality and a decency that says a person who works hard all day, every day, 5 days a week, ought to be paid more wages than what would leave him or her in poverty, if that kind of morality is part of your life, then you support the minimum wage, and that's why it won in Seattle. Finally, a story from the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, about Finland, a little-known country in Northern Europe, that does something interesting that I wanted to bring to your attention because I hadn't known it. In Finland, if you get a speeding ticket, that's right, a ticket from a police officer because you've been driving your car too quickly, the ticket you get, the fine you have to pay, is made proportional to your income. In other words, if Rockefeller gets a speeding ticket and is told it's going to cost you $100, whereas an average person gets a speeding ticket and is told it'll cost you $100, here's what we got. The disincentive to speeding will be strong for the poor person. It'll be virtually nothing for the rich one. For Mr. Rockefeller, a $100 fine is the equivalent of you dropping a penny, if even that. You don't worry a lot about it. It doesn't shape your behavior. So Finland long ago decided, hey, in order to make a ticket something that really mean something to a person so they won't be so quick to do this illegal act, to speed and risk other people's lives so quickly. In order to achieve that, we need to make the fine proportional to the income. And that's what they do. They treat fines the way we used to treat federal taxes. That is, the higher your income, the higher the percentage you pay. Finland does that, but also makes people pay fines. Give you one example. In 2003, Jussi Salonoja, a wealthy person, was fined for doing 80 kilometers an hour in a 40 kilometer per hour zone. His fine, $200,000. Because that would be the equivalent percentage of his income that would be charged to a person of lesser means. What an interesting idea to effect a better control on your people by making the fine you pay for illegal act be proportional to the income that you have and bring to your role in the economy. Let me turn now to more substantive conversations and topics, as we often do. And here I want to talk a little bit with you, both before and after our mid-program break, which we'll come to in a few minutes, about hospital charges. The last week has brought me a number of beautiful and moving emails about people devastated by medical care charges. These are either uninsured people or people with a private insurance, but it has a copay or a deductible that means they have to come up with hundreds or thousands of dollars, which they simply do not have, which plunges them, notice this, plunges them at a time of medical difficulty into also having financial crisis. You know, one of the least important things you can do in this world is to compound a problem with another problem. You want to help a person who has medical problems? Don't add financial problems to his or her life, particularly not at that moment. But that's what our system does. We have no comprehensive medical insurance. We have a patchwork system I'm going to talk about in a minute. But it is causing major havoc across the United States, particularly harming people, as I say, who have a medical problem and then discover, given our strange economic system, that their medical problem directly segues or pushes them into a financial problem coming literally at the worst possible time. So the New York Times, back on June 3rd, had an interesting story. And here's what it taught me. It's about hospital charges. And the New York Times research shows that hospitals around the country are raising their fees for all kinds of services much, much faster than the cost of living is going up, than prices on average are going up. The hospitals, in short, are sticking it to all of us. And the question is, what's this about? Well, there are three ways a hospital gets paid when you go in there and you have a procedure done and you're sent a bill. If you're covered by Medicare, then what the hospital gets is a Medicare-approved payment, typically much lower than what it says on the bill you get from the hospital. The hospital knows very well what it's going to get from Medicare. It is neither surprised or shocked, whatever it may say, because these are well-established Medicare reimbursement rates. But not everybody's covered by Medicare. Obviously, everybody who isn't 65, for example, isn't covered by Medicare. If you're covered by a private insurance, then a deal is struck, and that deal is always open to negotiation, between the hospital and the private insurance company as to what portion of the bill will be paid by the insurer for you when you went to the hospital. And finally, for uninsured people, hospitals send them a bill and often will offer them a quote-unquote discount. But here now you can see how tempting it is for hospitals to game this system. The higher you jack up the rates, that won't affect so much what you get from Medicare, because that's the government and they're going to give you what they're going to give you. But you might be able to get more out of the privately insured, and you might be able to get more out of the uninsured. And that's what's been going on. And so the insurance companies, having to give the hospitals more as these rates go up, in turn push bigger deductibles on the individuals or put bigger premiums on the employer to cover his or her employees, and with the uninsured, just send them a bill that plunges them into a debt they never escape. It is a catastrophe. And when I come back from our short mid-program break, I will explain, or try to, what this is all about. Thank you so much for being with me in this first half hour. We will take a very short break and then come back to Economic Update. Please join me.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Oh, the times, they are a-changing. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing. Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt...
Welcome back. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. We are now entering the second half of our program, and as always, I want to remind you that we maintain two websites which contain much more material along the lines of what we do in this program that allow you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest simply by clicking on the icon for those social media that you'll find at our websites that also allow you to send us comments and questions. So again, please do make sure of make use of rdwolf.com. And democracyatwork.info. Before the break, we were talking about the medical care economics in this country. I was talking about how and why we are experiencing the explosive upsurge of hospital rates and the enormous burdens that they mean, particularly for people covered by no insurance at all, which are in the tens of millions in the United States, or covered by private insurances that are constantly questioning, changing the coverage, all with the simple purpose of putting more and more of the burden of rising hospital costs onto all of us. I think the thing to understand is that we have a medical complex in the United States. You might call it the medical industrial complex. It's composed of four industries: hospitals, doctors, drug and appliance company manufacturers, and the insurers. And they have worked out a comprehensive deal. The insurers cover the rising costs sent to them by doctors and hospitals. Why? Because the doctors and hospitals, in return, support the insurers in jacking up their premiums. And they support, the doctors and hospitals do, insurers raising their premiums in return for the insurance company allowing them to raise their rates. And all of them support the drug companies in the enormous charges they put for medications and appliances of all kinds, because in return, the drug and appliance makers support the insurers in raising their rates, the doctors and hospitals. You understand? These four industries pat each other on the back, cover each other, support each other. And the net result is the absurd financial system of medical care in the United States. Why absurd? This is the simplest summary statistic that shows this. We in America pay more for our medical care than any other advanced country, or indeed any country, in the world. 17-18% of our total output of goods and services is money in the pocket of these four industries: doctors, hospitals, drug and device makers, and insurers. The quality of our medical care is mediocre. Our outcomes, length of life, children that survive the first year, chronic disease, is in the middle. Better than some countries, worse than many. So we pay more than everybody else, and our results are no better and often worse than other people. If they didn't have a stranglehold on this economy, this medical industrial complex, we wouldn't be in that situation. I want to turn next to an extraordinary event that happened on the 27th of May, brought to my attention by one of my listeners and viewers, and I'm grateful to this person for doing that. Here's what happened, and it really deserves our attention. On May 27th, in a very elegant locale of London, England, Mansion House and Guildhall, it's called, there was a conference. Oh, was this a conference? It was hosted by the Lord Mayor of London and the Rothschild Bank establishment, or one wing of it. It had the following four keynote speakers. And I'm going to present these without comment in the way they're listed on the website, where you can go and check all this out if you're interested. The website is called inclusivecapitalism.org. The first keynote speaker, His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales. Second keynote speaker, Mark Carney, the Governor of the Bank of England. Third keynote speaker, Bill Clinton, former President of the United States. And fourth, Christine Lagarde, who's currently the head of the International Monetary Fund. They were the keynote speakers at something called the Conference on Inclusive Capitalism. Wow. Let's take a look. Who got together? Well, they say this very, very proudly. They mention that gathered together here were top, I'm reading from their website, top executives from institutions representing more than $30 trillion in investable asset. One-third of the world's total wealth will be in attendance. Their aim will be to establish tangible steps that firms can take to begin changing the way business is done and rebuilding public confidence in capitalism. Now, I can't read to you, partly because I can't stand it, frankly, all that they say about themselves as they congratulate themselves, but I want to give you the core of what's going on here. These folks are not about to do what, for example, conservatives, many spokespersons for the Republican Party in the United States and for similar parties around the world do. That is, these leaders of industry are not about to deny that modern capitalism is having awful social effects. Now, true, they call them, and I quote, side effects. But let me give you an idea of what they say and what they admit. And they make this the foreground of what they do. I'm going to read it to you from them, from this richest of the rich. 1.2 billion poorest people on the planet account for just 1% of global consumption. A little over a billion poor, 1% of consumption. The richest billion, same number of people, account for 72% of consumption. Wow. They quote another recent report from Oxfam that I've also talked about on this program that found that the 85 richest people in the world have accumulated the same wealth as the bottom 3.5 billion, that's with a B. They bemoan, these folks do at this conference, that the latest Edelman Trust Barometer, they measure people's feelings, show that less than half of the global population trusts government, and business fares but not much. People have lost their confidence. They see that capitalism is a disaster for them. They mention here Arab Spring, Earth Day, and Occupy Wall Street by name. And they point out also that many are critical of capitalism as a threat to the environment. So here they are, the leaders of global capitalism. They don't want to waste any more time on what the conservative and right-wing political spokespeople they fund are saying. They're not interested in denying these consequences of how capitalism works. And the reason they're not interested is that hasn't helped. That still hasn't done anything to change these realities I just listed, which worry them. Wow. They think something now has to be done, way beyond denial. You have to face what capitalism is doing, they say, and persuade people that they should be pro-capitalist nonetheless. In other words, don't deny it. Try to work around it. And they've gathered these folks together to make a case. And here's how they summarize it. And I will read to you from this. Winston Churchill famously observed that democracy is the worst form of government, apart from all the others that have been tried. Were he alive today, he might think the same of capitalism as a vehicle for economic and social progress. So here's the point of this conference. Bring together the richest of the rich, the biggest leaders of the biggest corporations that dominate this grotesquely unequal global capitalism, and figure out and implement a program to persuade people to be pro-capitalist, because despite all of these awful consequences, it's the best there is. Oh, wow. We're moving from denial of what capitalism does to the mass of people to a program championed, among others, by Bill Clinton, whose job it is to get people to accept this system, to become resigned to this system, to become part of a campaign to say, whatever these effects are, this is still the best we can do, the best the human race can do. Capitalism needs to be preserved, no matter what its consequences for the mass of people. This is extraordinary. This is a kind of circling of the wagons among the capitalists. Denial of what they're doing to the mass of people hasn't worked. So now we have to convince the mass of people that however horrific their economic prospects are, and however horrific their economic conditions are, this is the best of all possible worlds, and you should just take it. The world cannot do better than capitalism is the message of this institution. The alternative, the idea that the world can, long ago should have, and now must do better than capitalism, is the perspective this group of political and economic leaders wishes to silence, to defeat, and to close down. All right. In the remaining section of this program, I want to address some of the many, many questions that have come in. We've selected a few. We're going to give a little bit more time than we normally do to this, just to begin to work on the backlog. Okay, quickly. Are H-1B visas really necessary to address the alleged skills gap? Well, for those of you not familiar, we have pretty tight controls on immigration into the United States. But we make certain exceptions as a nation, and one of the exceptions is these H-1B visas are designed to bring into the United States highly skilled workers from other countries who want to come here, to give them a pass so they're not subject to the other limits and restrictions on immigration. These are defended, as this question shows, by the argument we need these skills, so we should make exceptions. The truth of the matter is, yes, we need these skills, but we don't need to make exceptions. We have lots of Americans either who could get those jobs or, with a little training, could be brought up to speed to do those jobs. The real interest of those who push for these visas isn't to have access to skills, since we could provide that from our own people. And there are many arguments as to why that would be the appropriate way to go. The real interest is that around the world, there are highly skilled people willing and able to come to the United States and work for less money than the employers in this country want to pay skilled workers. The employers don't want to pay U.S. levels of wages. They don't want to pay to upgrade the skill levels so they could pay Americans. They would prefer, not to put too fine a point on it, cheaper foreign skilled workers. And that's why they've pushed for this special opportunity. This is not the question, which I have no interest in doing, the particular circumstances of an individual in another country who wants to come here. But we're not talking about this as an individual question. We're talking about the economics of creating that. By bringing skilled workers from the rest of the world into the United States, to whom you can pay much less and still be giving them a salary way above what they had before, is a way to lower the overall level of salaries and wages here in the United States. That's why it's interesting to American employers, and that's why they make sure that exists. Second question. If endless economic growth is both unsustainable and logically impossible, why does everyone keep citing it as the panacea for all our problems? Well, this is a very interesting question, very good point. For generations, for centuries, as long as capitalism has been the dominant system, there's been the built-in contradiction and tension of a capitalist system, namely the opposed interests of the worker and the employer. The less the employer has to pay the worker, the more is left after you sell the output for profits. The more you pay the worker, the less is left for the employer as profits after you sell the output. There, right there, is a conflict, one of many, between them. That has often led to struggles. Workers feeling they need and want and deserve more, employers determined not to give them more in order to maintain or raise the profits, which is what they want out of the production relationship. And that can produce strikes, and that can produce conflict, and that can produce revolution. Those frightened by the prospects of these consequences, strikes, demonstrations, revolution, those who have always been frightened because capitalism has this built-in contradiction that regularly explodes and really shakes the society, have convinced themselves over the decades that the way to avoid the problem is to keep growing, to produce more and more. Because that way, you can give more to the employer, so he's happy his profits are going up, and more to the worker, because you've produced more. Think of it this way. People who fight over, I want a bigger piece of the pie than you're getting, might be willing to stop fighting with one another over pieces of the pie if the pie as a whole was growing so that your piece was also growing as the total did. So the idea was you get social peace in a society, you prevent capitalism from blowing itself up by making sure you increase output so the anger of those who don't have is modified, is reduced, because what they're getting is growing. Even though relative to the people at the top, they're just as far away from them this year as they were 5, 10, and 15 years ago. The problem is this quote-unquote solution to capitalism's internal contradiction now has run up against its own problem. We don't stand ever-growing output. We are destroying our environment. We are destroying this planet as we produce more. That is, the resolution of capitalism's internal contradictions and the social conflict it provokes used to be to grow, but now that's producing its blowback, its problem. And so we're confronted back with the underlying question, maybe we need to deal with our system, since the Grow Forever solution to our system's problems is no longer available to us. And I think that's what's exactly happening around the world. People are beginning to recognize that capitalism is the problem. And that's what we haven't addressed, and that's what's now on the agenda. And that indeed connects back to the Conference for Inclusive Capitalism we were just talking about. They too understand they can't dodge the bullet. They're confronting a world that is understanding capitalism is full of contradictions, and we can't grow our way out of them the way we used to because that's too dangerous. So now their goal is get everybody to accept capitalism as the best there is and simply resign themselves into an eon of grotesque inequality. Next question. Soros, Buffett, and other wealthy investors have been recently reported to be selling their shares in the stocks of companies that make consumer goods, food, clothing, shelter, toiletries, furniture, kitchen equipment, the stuff that consumers buy. And this questioner wants to know, is there something going on because the investors seem to be worried that they're invested in companies that aren't going to make it and that we're facing an economic crash? Here's the answer. Nobody knows how the stock market is going to work in the next few years. All that anybody ever has is an educated guess. But in the phrase educated guess, the underlining should be on guess, because it's mostly a guess and only a little bit educated. We don't know. But here's what is in the minds of people who think like this. We have had the worst crisis since 2007 that we've had since the Great Depression. The recovery, so-called, has really only affected the folks at the top 5% of our people. The mass of people have not seen a recovery. And it's beginning to be that they can't use their savings because they've used them up. They can't borrow more money because they're already carrying more debt than they can safely carry or that anyone will lend to them. So their wages aren't going up. So if their wages aren't going up and they have no savings more to draw from and they can't borrow anymore, the ways we kept this thing going in the last 30 years, then we're looking at a situation, where consumer buying is going nowhere fast in the United States. And I think investors are saying, wow, get your money out of this kind of a company. The only consumer company you should be in is a consumer company that is busy outside the United States, because there some markets may be growing. But the United States is a place where unemployment remains high and real wages have gone nowhere for the last 5 or 6 years of crisis. This is not a time or a place for you to make investments in companies that are going to be hurt by this situation. Now, I'm not giving anyone advice. Let me be crystal clear. I don't give advice. This program is not about investment advice. I'm answering a question about how reasoning is done by the people who do believe that it's not a good time to invest in consumer items. Next question. I hear a lot all my life, this questioner writes, about socialism and communism. Most of my life, I thought they were the same, but I'm getting the idea that maybe they're different. Could you explain the difference? Sure, I can explain it, and I can also explain why you think it's the same, or you mostly did for most of your life. If you were a European, for those of you that are European, and I have many European listeners and viewers, you're very comfortable and understand the difference between socialism and communism because, for example, you have in your society a socialist political party and a communist political party, and both of those parties spend a good bit of time telling the public what the difference is between them and why you should be favoring the one or the other. So you grow up in a society in which what socialism is and means is institutionally different from what communism is and means and so forth, and that's widely discussed and widely understood. In the United States, we do not have a significant socialist political presence as an organized party, and even less a communist party. That is, we have a socialist party, we have a communist party, but they are so small, they are denied access to the media on such a systematic level that most Americans never hear about that. So that's why we don't know. Technically, what's the difference? Socialists have come to believe, and by the way, once upon a time, there wasn't much difference. Before 1920, before the end of World War I, we mostly had in the world socialist parties. There were no such thing as communist parties. After World War I, with the Russian Revolution, the socialist movement around the world split into those who wanted to continue to call themselves socialists, but were not keen on what was going on in the Soviet Union, the new socialist economy. And remember, the Soviet Union stands for Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. It's a country that called itself socialist. But it was led by a party that was disagreeing with parties in other parts of the world. The socialist movement globally split, and those who favored the new socialist country, the Soviet Union, took the name communist to distinguish themselves from the other socialists who were critical or at least not supportive of the Soviet Union. So that's when we had a split between the socialists and the communists over how to evaluate and deal with a socialist society like the Soviet Union. More recently, it has come to mean this. Socialists want a big role for the government to offset the inequalities and injustices of capitalism, to create a society that is more humane, with a more human face, with more social welfare. That's what socialists tend to believe. Communists usually want to go a good bit further. They kind of agree with the socialists, but they don't think that's doable if the government doesn't own and operate a large or even a total portion of the businesses of the society. So government control and government ownership and government operation tends to be what communists have wanted, whereas socialists don't go that far, but want a much more social welfare kind of society, even if they allow, as most socialists now do, private enterprises to survive and so on. The lines between socialism and communism vary and shift from time to time. It's not a fixed notion. But that's the general idea. Well, we've come to the end of another one of our programs. This one has been chocked full. I've tried to do more quantity and spend a little less time on each one. I'd be interested in your reactions and advice about whether it is or isn't a way to proceed in the future. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff. Thank you for joining me, and I look forward to talking with you again next week. Change.